The Yemeni army conducts a warning strike to stop the illegal shipping of Yemeni oil by the Saudi-led coalition. The Taliban say they've killed several Daesh operatives who were involved in a recent bloody attack on a female school. Plus, China wraps up the Communist Party Congress with a resolution confirming the core status of President Xi Jinping. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story this hour, Yemen's army says it has carried out a drone attack on a southern oil port to warn the Saudi-led coalition against plundering the country's resources. The army spokesman says what he called the basic warning strike was aimed at preventing a tanker from looting Yemeni crude through an oil terminal in Hadhramawt province. Yahya Sari' says the vessel violated a ban on the transfer and export of Yemeni oil products. He also vowed more such strikes to prevent the plunder of the country's oil wealth. This is the first such incident since a UN brokered truce between Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement and the Saudi-led coalition came to an end earlier this month. The coalition launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015. Yusuf Mowry is our correspondent in Sana'a and joins us now. Yusuf, what more can you tell us about this warning attack? We know that the looting of Yemen's natural resources was at the heart of the ending of the truce in Yemen.
Well, yeah, the peace agreement basically ended military activities on paper. However, you still have much of Yemen's natural resources being looted by foreign nations under the government of the Saudi-backed government, right? So what you basically have here at play is a corrupt government being backed by Saudi Arabia that's basically selling Yemeni oil and gas to foreign companies, most of which reside in Europe, and they're basically selling the natural resources, gas and oil, below international market price, and they're basically, these corrupt officials are making money under the table. And the message being delivered here by the Sana'a government is, enough is enough, the game is over, no longer will Yemen allow its natural resources to be looted by foreign nations because of corrupt government officials being backed by Saudi Arabia and a Saudi-led coalition. And this is why the Sana'a government launched these two bomb-driven drones which targeted the terminal, in the port of Adaba, to basically send a message that if this Greek oil ship loads any oil or gas resources onto the ship, it's going to be targeted. They will target any ship, any oil ship, any cargo ship in the vicinity that attempts to enter the country illegally under the guarantees of the Saudi-backed Yemeni government, which has proven its corruptness over and over again. Since 2018, this government under Saudi Arabia has been illegally selling 2 million barrels of oil, of Yemeni oil, to foreign companies, to foreign nations. And these nations basically think that they can just come into Yemen and take whatever natural resources they are given by the Saudi government, the government backed by Saudi Arabia here in Yemen. And the Sana'a government, the Ansarullah movement, is saying this will no longer be a reality, and they're willing to take the military measures to bring an end to this as soon as possible. So, from this day on, going forward, any ship or any company that attempts to steal or loot Yemeni oil, they're going to be targeted by ballistic missiles or, aerial drones being launched from Sana'a government-controlled areas.
So, Yusuf, in essence, what we have is that foreign companies are taking advantage of a very brutal blockade of Yemen to loot the country's oil and prevent the government from paying the salaries to its staff. Now, we've seen during the recent military parades, very impressive military parades in Sana'a and other places, surface to sea missiles. What you're saying is that this was a warning. Are we expecting to see the next retaliatory operation to strike one of those vessels, foreign vessels?
Well, I think the message that was delivered yesterday was very clear, right? And I think the Ansar Allah movement has been very articulate in sending the message that this is a new era in Yemen. Yemen's sovereignty will be respected. If respect is not given to Yemeni sovereignty and Yemeni natural resources, then this respect is going to be taken by military force. And of course, we've seen the displays of military equipment by the Ansar Allah movement. They have the military capability to deliver devastating blows to any nation in the region, let alone a cargo ship that's attempting to loot natural oil resources. And this has been the reality in Yemen. You know, people will often ask, why is Yemen the poorest nation in the Middle East? Well, the reason for that is because you have, you know, previously you had a corrupt government that was basically giving away Yemeni gas, Yemeni oil, so that corrupt government officials can make a profit under the table, while basically leaving the Yemeni people to starve and leaving the Yemeni people without their monthly salaries and their basic necessities, having access to them, right? So this is I can say that Ansar Allah movement has always delivered on its promise. They usually send a warning first, a peaceful warning, and if that warning is not respected, then what follows suit after that is military actions that would deliver, devastating blows, as we have seen unfold in the past.
And we have indeed seen use of retaliatory operations that put intense pressure on Saudi Arabia and its American-backed ally to end the war or a ceasefire for now. Yusuf, thank you very much indeed for that. Yusuf Mowry there, our correspondent, joining us live from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. All five Iranian crew members of a Venezuelan cargo plane that was grounded in Argentina back in June have arrived in Caracas. They are among 19 crew members of a Boeing 747 cargo plane grounded over alleged violation of U.S. sanctions. Venezuela's transport minister has expressed happiness over the freedom of all crew members who, he said, were kidnapped by the Argentine judiciary. The plane had been sold by Iran's Mahan Air to Venezuelan airliner Emtrans. Both sanctioned by the U.S., the aircraft carrying auto parts landed in the Argentine capital en route from Mexico on June 6th. It was not permitted to refuel in Argentina, where authorities detained its crew on the request of a U.S. court. An Argentinian judge recently said the documents provided by the plaintiff were insufficient and invalid. Syria says it has intercepted another Israeli missile attack over Damascus shortly after reports of explosions in the airspace of the capital city. The Syrian Defense Ministry says the missiles were targeted at areas in the vicinity of Damascus. It says air defenses shot down most of the missiles, adding that the attack caused limited material damage. That's the first such air raid in more than a month. Israel has carried out hundreds of strikes against Syria, targeting government troops as well as allied forces. One of the latest such attacks hit around the capital, Damascus, in September, killing 5 army soldiers. A funeral has been held for a 19-year-old Palestinian who lost his life during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Mourners condemned Israeli crimes and called for justice. Saleh Bariki died after being shot in the neck as Israeli forces stormed Jenin in the early hours of Friday. 3 other Palestinians were also wounded during the raid. In reaction, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas stressed that the raids won't undermine Palestinians' determination to liberate all of Palestine. Hamas also pledged that it won't let the Palestinians' blood to be spilled in vain. For months, the Israeli military has been conducting a brutal campaign to quash growing resistance in Jenin, killing dozens of Palestinians during its invasions. The latest victim brings to 124 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank this year. Right, let's go to the Taliban, Afghanistan. Important events there. The Taliban say they have killed six Daesh members in an overnight operation in the Afghan capital, Kabul. According to the Taliban, the terrorists were involved in two major attacks in recent weeks. Both occurred in Kabul. One took place on September 30. It hit a school's girl, killing 53 people, most of them female students. The other occurred a week earlier. It hit a mosque, killing seven people and injuring over 40. A series of explosions have rocked different Afghan cities, mostly the capital, since the Taliban took over the country in August 2021. Most of the attacks were claimed by Daesh. China's Communist Party has approved amendments to its charter endorsing President Xi Jinping's, quote, core leadership. Hours ago, the party unanimously passed a resolution on the changes as it concluded its 20th National Congress. It introduced a new central committee of around 200 senior party officials. The committee is expected to keep Xi as the party's general secretary when it meets on Sunday. That would pave the way for him to gain a third term as China's president in March, when the government's annual legislative sessions are held. Some 2,300 delegates of the Communist Party attended the week-long Congress, which is held twice a decade. Conservative British lawmakers are declaring who they're backing to become the party leader and next prime minister after Liz Truss's resignation left the position up for grabs. So far, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his former finance minister Rishi Sunak are leading the race with the most backing from MPs. Many British politicians doubt that Johnson will receive the 100 nominations he needs, or anyone or any nominee needs, from lawmakers to run for the position. They are citing a lack of confidence in Johnson as his recent premiership was blighted with scandals and allegations of misconduct. Penny Mordaunt, who is popular with party members, is the only one to formally declare her candidacy for Tory leadership so far. Liz Truss quit on Thursday after only 6 weeks in office. There were growing calls for her to resign over a host of issues, including her controversial economic package. Right, let's return to our earlier story regarding China's Communist Party, which has approved amendments to its charter endorsing President Xi Jinping's, quote, core leadership, and bring in Andrew Leung, independent China specialist. Andrew, welcome. So, you know, we've seen Chinese economic growth and its standing on the international community expand vastly under President Xi. What more can you tell us about his presidency and this Congress that has been held, the session that has been held?
Well, if you look at the Western media, they are all zeroing in on Xi's apparent grab on power and also more aggressiveness in the international arena, almost kind of continuing blackening China without paying any attention that the bulk of the Party Congress is about China's domestic governance, which is the pride of the Communist Party, because under the Communist Party, the lives of the Chinese people have changed miraculously and over the past decades, especially under President Xi. The economy has grown, the GDP per capita has doubled, and China's influence is growing around the world. So there is no wonder that there is considerable consensus even though there are necessarily some dissenting voices, but they are in the minor minority. So the consensus in the party is that Xi is the man to take China to a higher plane. Higher plane meaning another milestone in realizing the China dream of becoming a modern socialist country by the year 2035, and also an advanced socialist country, stronger nation, richer nation, more democratic, and ecologically more beautiful, and more harmonious, a more innovative country by the year 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. So the entire party congress is about that. Of course, territorial integrity is part of the dimensions. The unification of Taiwan is on the agenda, but stressing, of course, the need for peaceful unifications. If only pushing Taiwan in a hastened step towards negotiations. But the bulk of the Congress is about not only past achievements, but the roadmap ahead. I think there is considerable rallying behind President Xi, and then the indications are that tomorrow we're going to see a new team being let in, because a number of the existing top leaders, the top,
right.
top seven, half of them are retiring.
Andrew, very
younger leaders.
Very quickly, we have like a minute left. We've heard from some research and studies that have been conducted that over the past decade, and some have said even perhaps 7 or 8 years, China will overtake the United States as the number one superpower in the world in economy, military, and so on. What's your thoughts on that, if you can, in a minute?
Well, I think that because of the pandemic and because of rising internal problems, I think that the consensus still points to 2030 or thereabouts. But this is not the be-all, end-all of China's aim. China's aim is not to overtake another country, not to supplant another country, but to put its own house in order and to bring about better lives for its people. And I think that China is on track to achieving that.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed for that. Andrew Leong, the independent China specialist, joining us live from Hong Kong. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Acts of violence and vandalism by Israeli settlers targeting Palestinian properties are routine in the West Bank throughout the year. Reports of acts of violence and vandalism against Palestinians are also rarely prosecuted by the Zionist regime forces. Olive trees are an indispensable source of revenue for many Palestinians, particularly in the West Bank, and acts of vandalism are a deliberate attempt to stifle their means of income. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. In this regard, Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The olive harvest season in Palestine has started. For Palestinians, the olive harvest is not just important for the local economy, but is a national event expressing unity, social cohesion, and defiance of the Israeli regime occupation. The Zionist regime often erases ancient olive groves in the occupied Palestinian territories to build illegal Jewish settlements, confiscate Palestinian land for whatever military purpose, or simply break the spirit of ordinary Palestinians. This is why the olive harvest is an important Palestinian occasion to send a message back to the Zionist regime that the relationship with their land is as strong as ever." Meanwhile, the website of the Electronic Intifada on the Zionist regime's settlers' attacks on Palestinian farmers wrote, "Firas Youssef is taking all the precautions he can to fend off ever more aggressive settler attacks on his land west of Salfit in the occupied West Bank. The farmer 37 has already seen his land, 30,000 square meters outside the town of Azavia, divided into two by Israeli regime separation wall, where it dips deep into the West Bank, southwest of Nablus, in the Salfit Governorate. Never peaceful settlers from the nearby settlements of Ariel, Alei Zahav, Pudul, and Varkan have been acting even more aggressively over the past several months. Last year, according to the UN, Palestinians in the West Bank had to endure the highest recorded levels of settler violence in recent years. Fearing for his safety as well as his livelihood, Youssef has constructed a wooden hut on top of one of his bigger olive trees. The hut is about 5 meters squared and is built on the tree trunk, some 3 meters up. It is outfitted with plastic windows and boasts a sheet metal roof. A single solar panel provides electricity. Inside, there are chairs, covers, and bedding, enabling Youssef to stay overnight on his land. This serves two purposes. He can keep an eye on his land at night, and he is not subject to the capricious moods of Israeli troops at checkpoints to reach his land in the mornings. Yusuf is by no means the only farmer to come up with this idea. He estimates that around 230 other local farmers have built huts on their lands for the same purpose. He fears, however, that the Israeli military might come and destroy the hut, as has happened to others. Settlers are wreaking havoc in small communities around the West Bank. Hardly a day goes by without some reports of cars being vandalized, civilians being assaulted, or trees being targeted. There are more than 280 settlements in the West Bank, outside of East Al-Quds. These are home to some 440,000 settlers, lured there by tax breaks and other financial incentives offered by the Zionist regime. Some 150 of these are so-called settlement outposts, attracting more extreme elements among the settlers. Some of these outposts are being legalized to become full settlements. A third of the outposts were established over the last decade. All pose a threat to the security of Palestinians in the vicinity, and the Zionist regime military is another source of danger for farmers and others. At least 26 children have been killed by troops or settlers this year alone. Most settler attacks take place in Area C. Some 60% of the occupied West Bank, which is under direct Israeli regime military and administrative control. Yusuf Farm is in Area C, where the Zionist regime apartheid system is quite brazen. Israeli settlers are treated as civilians under Israeli law, while Palestinians like Yusuf in the same area are subject to military rule. There is little to no protection for Palestinians in Area C or anywhere else. The military does not have the authority to intervene against settlers since they are seen as civilians. It is a fine distinction that B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights group, calls meaningless. Settler violence, the group holds, is a form of government policy, and troops almost never have to face any consequences for their actions. According to another Israeli rights group, Yesh Din, in the years 2019 and 2020, the Zionist regime military received a total of 273 complaints related to violations committed by troops against Palestinian civilians. Of these complaints, just 56 investigations were opened, or about a fifth of all complaints submitted. Yesh Din attributed the small number of opened investigations, a number that is decreasing year on year, to a deliberate policy to raise the threshold for opening criminal investigations. Ultimately, the group found only 2% of complaints resulted in prosecution. Ahmad Al-Mahmoud, 66, from Kafar Al-Dik, further west from Salfit, suffers constant vandalism by settlers from the nearby Al-Izahaf settlement, to which he has already lost 6,000 square meters of his 13,000 square meters of land, now surrounded by a metal fence and off-limits to him. Murad Shatvi, head of the Colonization and Wall Resistance Commission of the Northern West Bank and a coordinator for unarmed resistance marches, told the Electronic Intifada that settlements have led to the confiscation of thousands of dönems of agricultural land in the Salfit Governorate. The entire area of the governorate is about 26,000 dönems, Shetfi said, with 11,000 located in Area A and under the Palestinian Authority, and 15,000 dönems are in Area C. A dönem is equivalent of 1,000 square meters. Salfit Governorate contains 25 Israeli settlements, Shetfi added, the largest of which is Ariel, which is built on land belonging to the villages of the area, including Kafar al-Dik and al-Zawiya. The most dangerous settlement project in Salfit is the occupation's attempt to expand the Ariel settlement by establishing an industrial zone there and linking it to a settlement that is being planned in the Ras area and Khalat Hassan area west of Salfit. Ahmad al-Mahmoud also built a hut on his land. In fact, it was built several times because the Israeli regime military kept demolishing it. The latest demolition was in September 2020. He rebuilt it less than 2 months later. Today, the hut is multifunctional, including as a recreational place for his family and grandchildren. Settler attacks increase more during the harvest seasons, al-Mahmoud told the Electronic Intifada, adding, especially the olive harvest. Settler gangs prepare themselves for the September-November harvest by cutting down olive trees and stealing their fruits. And it is not just Palestinians who are targets. Settlers have been known to target foreign and Israeli activists when these have turned up to protect farmers for the harvest, pelting them with stones or assaulting them with clubs. Al-Mahmoud does not only have to contend with direct assaults, he told the Electronic Intifada. When the Zionist regime in administrative control over the area, he has yet to receive permission to dig a water well for irrigation purposes. He still has to rely on trucks carrying water tanks to irrigate his trees once a week.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful under international law. That's what a UN-appointed commission of inquiry has said. The Rights Commission has called on the UN to end Israel's permanent occupation and urges prosecution of Israeli officials. As expected, Tel Aviv rejected the report as being anti-Semitic. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the different aspects of the report and examine the role of the International Court of Justice and other international bodies in holding Israel accountable for its crimes against Palestinians. Joining us for tonight's discussion, we have manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto. And also from Vancouver, international coordinator at Samarun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Ms. Charlotte Cates.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Ms. Cates in Vancouver. The report by the UN's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, which in fact will be presented to the General Assembly later in October, accuses Israel of violating international law by making its control over the West Bank permanent and by annexing land claimed by the Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds and the West Bank and Syrian land in the Golan Heights. Well, there have been many reports in this regard. In your opinion, what makes this report different?
In a lot of ways, this report isn't necessarily different, because we have seen, many, many very good reports published by many good UN commissions and agencies over the years that establish the incontrovertible facts that the Israeli occupation routinely violates international law. And in fact, I mean, when we look at the entire creation of the Zionist project on the land of Palestine, this is an exercise of colonialism. Colonialism itself is illegal under international law. So it really even goes beyond the 1967 military occupation to the nature of the Zionist settler project itself. What it does show, however, is that despite the influence of imperialist states like the United States, Canada, European Union countries, the UK, that there still is a measure of independence, and that the fact is that all of the military, political, and diplomatic support provided for the Zionist project by these states is not able to cover up, obscure, or hide the truth of the matter, which is that the Palestinian cause is a just struggle for justice, liberation, and return, and that on a daily basis, it is Palestinian rights that are being violated by an ongoing, Zionist onslaught of mass imprisonment, extrajudicial killings, occupation, colonization, siege, denial of the right of return, and crimes that go on and on for 74 years.
Firas Al-Najm, the report says there are reasonable grounds to conclude that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful under international law due to its permanence and the Israelis' de facto annexation policies. Of course, it says that this should not deprive the occupied power of its statehood nor its sovereignty. When will these condemnations go past just being mere platitudes? When will there be action?
Unfortunately, the United Nations is a biased body, and they have not really done anything for the Palestinian cause. They have never imposed sanctions or passed real resolutions that make real changes and punish and penalize the Zionist war criminal regime and the occupiers of the Holy Land of Palestine. And it's a continuous thing. We've been seeing this for 74 years, and it does not stop. I mean, every month there's some type of aggression. Every few days now, it's more constant now, because they feel, there's nobody's going to punish them. The United Nations is quiet. Most of the international key players are quiet as well, and the ones with the veto power and so on. I mean, few countries are speaking out and putting pressure and supporting the Palestinians. And one of them, obviously, is the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's why there's a huge campaign to defame them right now and to paint this wrong picture that they're human rights abusers, where they forget about the real human rights abusers is the Zionist regime. How much annexation, how many houses have they stole from Palestinians? And it's been recorded because of this modern technology that we have. How many phones were used to really, you know, highlight these issues of human rights violations? International law is being breached day and night by the Zionist regime. And the thing is, the Zionist regime really just disregards all these bodies because they've never held them really accountable. It's unfortunate, like even when the International Criminal Court, the ICC, was looking to investigate the Zionist regime for war crimes, the former prime minister of the Zionist regime comes out and says this is a kangaroo court. He says we don't even recognize it. So this is the type of rhetoric, this is the type of language these people have. They think they're above the law, you know, and they have the state of arrogance. And unfortunately, the only way it seems like it works with the Zionist regime is by military ways and military means. And you know, we've seen that things change once the strength of the Palestinian resistance hits the Zionist regime. We see that now with Gaza, they negotiate differently and they pull back and they retract and they become submissive. Even though they have all the type of advanced weapons, but this strong united resistance against the Zionist regime, I think, is the only solution. Because if we want to rely on the United Nations, we've seen they haven't done nothing. How come they have always spoke about these issues, have had condemnations and statements, but we haven't seen any real action? But we see now real action on the issue of Russia and Ukraine. How much sanctions have been imposed against Russia? How many meetings, important and emergency meetings have happened in the United Nations to condemn Russia, to impose all types of restrictions and sanctions against Russia and all its officials and so on? And it's only a conflict less than 1 year. We're talking 74 years of occupation. For us as a human rights organization, we don't want to see violence. We don't want to see people dying. We don't want to see, destabilization. But at the end of the day, we have to be logic, and we have to look at things, in a realistic way. And the realistic way is that the Zionist regime is only dealt with and things change when resistance is strong.
Charlotte Cates, that's an issue I wanted to bring up later on in the show, but now that Mr. Najem alluded to it, can we try and draw some comparison between the international response to the Ukraine conflict and the seven-decade-old occupation of Palestine? Why hasn't Israel been sanctioned and pressured and shunned by the international community to end its occupation of Palestinians?
Well, I think here it's always really important to talk about who we mean when we say the international community, because by and large, that term is used to mean the imperialist powers that are responsible for creating war, occupation, colonialism, extraction of resources from people around the world. And so the term international community, as if the responsible international community are those who are responsible for the ongoing war crimes and crimes against humanity. And so the reason why we see a difference in these responses and such a clear and striking difference isn't even that these states are hypocritical or that they have double standards. It's that they have interests, and that their interests are in seeing Zionist colonial power extended in occupied Palestine and dividing the Arab people and dividing the people of the region from one another through the presence of this essentially military colonial project of the Zionist state in occupied Palestine. And so in much the same way, we see that the United States is very much pursuing a war by multiple means against Russia and against any other power that it views as a potential challenger to its domination of the extraction of the resources of colonized and formerly colonized people around the world. And so it's no surprise that these imperialist powers are acting in their interests. But that's not the only international community, and that's not the only international community that matters. Obviously, there are a number of states, including Iran and including Arab states that have not yet conceded to the role of normalization, including resistance forces like we see in Lebanon, and including popular movements and people's movements around the world, both in the global south and the countries that have risen up against colonialism and continue to defend themselves, and in the capitals, the cities, the streets, and the towns of the imperialist powers themselves, that recognize that what is happening in Palestine is, in fact, a grand crime against humanity, and one that is being supported by U.S. imperialism, and one that needs to be brought to an end and to be stopped. And so that's why we are seeing a growth in campaigns to boycott and sanction Israel. And that's why instead what we're seeing are these imperialist powers instead trying to criminalize those boycott movements while saying that it is necessary to use sanctions as kind of a weapon of domination and control against countries from Iran to Russia to really one third of the world are subjected to U.S. sanctions of some form or another. And so it's really necessary to do everything that we can to build up that real international community, that real international community of all of those forces that are involved in resistance, to fight back and to stand with the Palestinian people and to stand with the Palestinian resistance for the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, because we can't rely on the United Nations. Instead, we have to act and organize.
Firas Al-Najm, the Israelis have rejected this report, obviously, calling its commissioners as being anti-Semitic and questioning their legitimacy. They say the report damages the UN's credibility and its human rights mechanisms. Also, U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price said that Israel is consistently unfairly targeted in the UN system, including in the course of this commission of inquiry. How hypocritical are these responses?
I mean, this is the hypocrisy of the Zionist regime, because it was established on hypocrisy and contradiction. And, this is what they always try to accuse people of, this victim card. Either they play the Holocaust card and try to, play the victim card all the time, so, people can have empathy for them, and they want to justify crimes by looking at crimes that have happened to let's just say the Jewish people before, or they play the anti-Semitic card, and play the victim card again, because they run out of cards now. They're in a very weak state right now, the Zionist regime, so they'll just keep throwing these type of cards around, and they don't get nowhere with them. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, they think they're above the law. Like when we argue with these people all the time and have different discussions and arguments and protests, we see that their mentality truly is that they believe that they are the chosen people, this is their chosen land, and this is their chosen battle. And they're brainwashed in this kind of manner, you know what I mean? And they don't care about international organizations, and they think that, God is assisting them in this all these criminal activities. But at the end of the day, we know that the resistance will enter Palestine. The resistance is strong. And the axis of resistance is more unified and more experienced now than ever in its history. And like Sayyid Khamenei said, the supreme leader of the Iranian government, he said that the solution is for the West Bank to be armed as Gaza, just something similar to Gaza, like the same model. Hopefully that will transfer to West Bank. And we see that right now. There is an ignition and there is this reviving revolutionary lifestyle happening now, where a lot of youth are rising up and fighting back the Zionist regime, while they think they can just, breach the international laws, go into Palestinian territories as they please, break all these, people's houses and things like that. And we're hopeful. I mean, like us, freedom people that are defending the people that are oppressed. We are really honestly hopeful that we're going to see a free Palestine in the near future. And it's unfortunate, this hypocrisy, where they're crying about one controversial case such as Mahsa Amini, and then they leave all the dead people that get killed in Palestine, such as Shirin Abu Akla, and all these people that we see clearly how the Israelis don't even care about any humanity at all. They kill women, they kill kids, they kill mothers, grandmothers, and nobody speaks about them. There's no outrage, there's no huge, Twitter hashtags being trended by all these government officials and all these organizations and all these activists, but they focus on that one case because they want to hurt Iran, because Iran is the main supporter of Palestine, and that's what hurts them. They hate a sovereign Iran and a strong Iran supporting the oppressed resistance of Palestine.
Charlotte Cates, the commission demanded the international system and individual states must act and uphold their obligations under international law. That must begin at this session of the General Assembly with the referral to the International Court of Justice on the legal consequences of Israel's continued occupation. This is, of course, an excerpt of the report from the commission. How can the ICJ have the leeway to intervene when Israel is not a member of the court and rejects its jurisdiction?
Yes, I mean, the ICJ has, of course, ruled before on Israeli crimes in 2004, on the building of the apartheid wall. And of course, at the ICC, in addition to what's happening at the ICJ, at the ICC, what we've seen is that, like, for example, legal organizations that are working to bring Palestinians' complaints to the ICC are being branded by the Zionist regime as terrorist organizations, essentially in retaliation for what they're doing to expose the Israeli occupation. We know that these kinds of agencies and even these courts aren't going to act on their own because they're also not apolitical institutions. So, for example, at the ICC, we've seen an announcement that Ukraine, once again, is being prioritized, whereas Palestine has been waiting for justice at the ICC for a very long time. And in fact, the entire decision to handle their case was viewed as controversial. And almost at risk at any time, despite the fact that there is an international recognition of a Palestinian state, however limited and insufficient that is. But that, once again, speaks to the fact that we see justice in the courts and in international arenas when we demand and seek justice in the streets and when the Palestinian resistance is organizing, leading, and fighting back. And that's why it is so important that we participate in actions. On October 29th, there's going to be a march in Brussels to the European Parliament to demand an end to the European Union's complicity in ongoing Zionist war crimes and crimes against humanity through, for example, we see the EU-Israel Association Agreement meeting with Israeli occupation leaders, and even when issuing weak criticisms, providing nothing more than strong, fundamentally diplomatic, military, financial, and political support to the Zionist regime. And so we want to encourage people everywhere that you can to support the Palestinian people in their resistance by taking to the streets, by coming out and marching, and by joining us in Brussels on October 29th to march to the European Parliament at 2 p.m.
For us, Najim, the report focused on a very important issue, and that's the issue of settlements, on how Israel has sustained and advanced its quote-unquote settlement enterprise, including statements made by Israeli officials indicating the intent to maintain permanent control over the land in violation of international law. The report also found that land is often confiscated for military purposes, but then used for settlement construction. What are the Israelis achieving with this land grab policy? Apart from Judaization of Palestinian land, are the Israelis also deliberately sabotaging any prospects of future Palestinian statehood?
Yes, I mean, this is part of their, plan is to weaken the Palestinians and always show them military pieces everywhere, in every corner, so, you know, they can never think that they would ever have their own army and their own state and their own strength and sovereignty. This is one of the main focuses of the Zionist regime, because they know that after they get that strength, then they will start to talk about all the human rights abuses for over these years, all the war crimes. Then they will be talking about compensation, bringing back all the refugees from Palestine. So that means their plan would have to fail, and they won't be able to fully control the land the way that they want to. So this is one of their plans, and it will fail. I think the only type of resolutions we can have to put some pressure, obviously, if the United Nations wakes up actually and really wants to implement the laws truly and put some severe sanctions against Israel, maybe they'll retract a little bit and start to pull away from these settlements. Or the other way is obviously the Palestinian resistance and the rockets, because then, you know, at that point, the settlers and occupiers will feel discouraged and feel, you know, fearful that they have to leave that area because the Palestinians want their land back and they're going to fight for it. And you know, well, like we said, we don't want to see no bloodshed. But if that's the only way it is to acquire your land and to liberate your land, then that's the only way. And it's also it's sanctioned in the Charter of Rights under the United Nations. Any occupied nation has a right to resist, right? And as we see right now, the Ukrainians are getting all types of weapons from Canada, from all types of countries, and it's totally illegal and it's totally honorable. But then when somebody wants to help the Palestinians, he's a sponsor of terrorism. It's like Iran supports the Palestinian resistance, inside Gaza, and they call them sponsors of terror. You see the hypocrisy and the bias. Type of actions is unbelievable, but it's all turning on them anyways, because we're exposing them. We're going out to these politicians and we're asking them, like, if you're supporting Ukraine and you're so proud of that, why don't you support the Palestinians that have been occupied for 74 years? And if you don't believe that they've been occupied, the United Nations says they're occupied. And now we have, these little statements here and there that, confirm that.
All right, that's all the time we have for this show. Thanks to manager Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto, and international coordinator Samadun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
show you.